month. One for Dan, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money's summer special series. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute. And while I hope you're having a break this summer, if you're anything like me, you'll still be craving a political fix. And we're here to help, giving you the best of from the Australia Institute's Popular Politics in the Pub and other live events from 2018. In 2008, in the face of the biggest economic threat to Australia and the global economy since the Great Depression, the Australian government responded with powerful stimulus measures. 10 years on, it's almost hard to remember how scary the headlines were back then, the sense of panic in financial circles and across the rest of the world. The Australia Institute held an event to mark the 10th anniversary of the stimulus package, which most people acknowledge helped keep Australia out of recession. And we invited former Treasurer Wayne Swan, Deputy Leader Tanya Plibersek, and then Principal Advisor to Wayne Swan, now Shadow Minister for Finance, Jim Chalmers, to speak to the audience. Jim Chalmers, in particular, provides a fascinating insight into what was happening behind the scenes, as well as a funny moment he describes as, I think, his proudest achievement as a political staffer. This audio was recorded live on the 14th of October at the Australia Institute's offices at The Level in Manuka, where our Executive Director, Ben Oquist, was our host for the evening.
It's important that we remember and reflect upon those events, learn from them and indeed promote them. And it's why the Australia Institute's been so pleased to be involved in a program of over a year now, looking and commemorating the events of 10 years ago, the good and the bad. And there are so many lessons still to be learnt. I was at a lunch of some business people on Friday in Sydney, and they were lamenting that they thought the progressive side globally hadn't earned enough credit and beaten its enemies enough over what happened 10 years ago. And that progressives hadn't sold the narrative of strong government fiscal intervention well enough. Well, maybe. But I think it's all the more reason why reflecting and promoting those events 10 years ago and the actions that governments took, and in particular the actions that governments in Australia took, is so important. So without any further ado, please welcome former Treasurer of Australia and National President of the Labor Party, Wayne Swan.
It's great to be here with two of my parliamentary colleagues who were absolutely central to the events of 10 years ago. Jim had a greater burden than tenure because Jim had to look after me 24 hours a day. So that was a bit of a challenge. But also tenure through her stewardship, particularly in housing, but more importantly, her participation in those discussions across the board, you know, were absolutely critical to what we did all the way through 2009 and beyond. Can I say I'm really pleased to have worked so closely with the Australia Institute over the last few years. They are making such an important contribution to the much-needed ideas debate that we should be having in this country, that the important role that government plays in the economy and in the wider society and how it must be defended if we are not only to grow our economy, but to grow our economy as fairly as possible. The GFC Plus 10 project has been a collaboration between the party and the Australia Institute, and is precisely the sort of collaboration that I, as National President, would like to see at a wider level across the community, taking these debates out there onto the ground and talking with people about these ideas, which are so important to our country's future. Now, understanding what happened 10 years ago, understanding how it happened, and understanding its consequences is absolutely critical to our future, not just to how we might handle the next crisis, but how do we craft our policy framework for the future to avoid those crises, and how do we craft it to have a better, fairer economic model which serves the country. Part of my motivation in being involved in this collaboration with the Australia Institute is that there has been an ongoing campaign across the board to demonise the role that government plays in our economy and in our society, and to delegitimise the role that government plays. The very concept of government intervening to protect people is foreign to political opponents here on the right in this country, who are much better funded when it comes to putting forward their alternative prescriptions for what some people might call neoliberalism, but what I prefer to call trickle-down economics. And part and parcel of this battle of ideas that we're engaged in is, Ben is right, that we have to be out there on the ground arguing the toss on these critical issues. And I was reflecting on these as I flew back overnight from the IMF meetings in Bali, because exactly 10 years ago to the day, I was flying back from the United States, where I had attended very important IMF meetings and a critical emergency G20 finance ministers meeting in Washington at the height of the crisis. And of course, 10 years ago, we were then talking about economic volatility, which we had not seen for 80 years. And it strikes me that as 10 years on, we are now talking about political volatility we have not seen for 80 years. And that tells us one critical thing about this discussion, that big economic events have very big political consequences. And the failure of any number of governments around the world to respond as effectively as they could have responded to what is known overseas as the Great Recession is the core behind the economic and social divisions that we are seeing right across the developed world as we speak. Essentially, the global financial crisis and the Great Recession shone a very bright light on 30 years of growing income and wealth inequality across the world. And it fanned, if you like, the resentments of the recipients of those who were on the wrong end of those economic developments over 30 years. So I think that's why this sort of discussion tonight is important. I just wanted to reflect very briefly with a story or two. The 7 days that led up to the publication and the release of our stimulus on the 14th of October 10 years ago were perhaps seven of the most momentous days that I've ever had in my life and certainly in my political life. And I think in many ways, I think Jim would have had the same experience. But essentially, from the day that the Reserve Bank cut interest rates by 100 basis points, which was a Tuesday, through that week, we flew to Washington for the annual IMF meetings. And part and parcel of that was going to Wall Street and going into meetings with bankers who were traumatised, and you were sitting there and you had the impression that if they could, some would be jumping out of the windows pretty soon. We were talking to senior people in finance who were saying, we're just sitting here waiting for the cavalry to arrive. We were talking with people who basically thought that the end of the economy as they knew it was nigh, and that unless government came to the rescue, unless the cavalry did arrive, then in fact we were staring down the Great Depression Mark II. Make no bones about it. As it was, with all of the coordinated action that was taken over the next 6 months, the American economy shrunk at least 4%. The German economy shrunk 6%. Most developed economies shrunk by double digits during this period. It was a crisis of enormous proportions. And, of course, there is a whole industry devoted in this country to denying that it happened. And, indeed, Peter Costello repeated this only last week. But you hear it in the Parliament all of the time. It's part of delegitimising the very substantial role that government can play to protect people. So as part of these meetings, there was an IMF meeting where finance ministers were wringing their hands, and it was then followed by an emergency G20 finance ministers meeting, which at the last minute was attended by President George Bush. And this is the big difference between where we are today and where we were 10 years ago. Because George Bush came to that meeting, and most people in this room would not have a very high opinion of George Bush, but George Bush turned up at that meeting and commenced the discussion at the meeting by apologising for what the United States financial sector had done to their own economy and to the economies of the developed and developing world. Could you imagine any American leader like Donald Trump doing that today? And, of course, the lesson here is that if we had a similar sort of crisis today, there would not be the coordinated international effort to actually solve the problem, such as the one that we had 10 years ago. And he also had a bit of a sense of humour, because this was a very fraught meeting. There were finance ministers talking about their economies falling off cliffs and precipices. I mean, there was a lot of pessimism in the room. And he was introduced at that meeting by the Brazilian finance minister who was chairing the meeting. And the Brazilian finance minister's English skills were not high. And he had opened by saying to George Bush, he'd apologised to George that his English wasn't good, and George Bush leaned over and said, "Neither is mine." And, of course, this was broadcast to the whole room. Later that night, Jim and I then participated in the cabinet meeting that was occurring in Canberra, Sunday morning Australian time, which took two of the most important economic decisions taken by an Australian government post-war, namely the decision to guarantee the banks and wholesale funding, and the wholesale funding was almost as important as the bank guarantee, and the decision to put in place a stimulus of the order of 10% of GDP. The thing was that we were in Washington, we were in the embassy compound, and we had some trouble getting a secure line to patch into the cabinet meeting happening here in the TARDIS in Canberra. As it turned out, they could only install the line into the basement bedroom of the teenage son of one of the embassy officials. So there's Jim and I sitting there, and I'm saying to the cabinet back in Canberra, the end is nigh. If you've got any doubt, just do more. Throw the kitchen sink at it. This is really difficult territory. And Jim and I are sitting there in the room, and of course we look up. And what do we see? We're sitting there looking up at a Jimi Hendrix poster. And I'm a big Bob Dylan fan, and of course I'm a fan of Jimi Hendrix's version of All Along the Watchtower, which is, I can't find my way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion here. I can't get no relief. So when you're policy making in these difficult circumstances, you really are operating on instinct, but you're also operating on making sure you can get the best available information as quickly as possible. And fortunately for us, fortunately for our country, our cabinet, our prime minister, our senior ministers, our party organisation, all of our MPs had the political guts to take this on and back their instinct and to back their leadership. And make no mistake, we knew when we took the decisions that we took, because we were already preparing the second stimulus package before we'd actually put out the first, we knew we would be hung, drawn and quartered by the Conservatives in Australia for having the temerity to do it. So there's a lot of talk about leadership in politics. There's a lot of written about it now, and some of it's very good. But there has been leadership in Australian politics, and it was shown there when it really counted. And the Australian economy would not be 30% plus larger today if it hadn't been for the actions that we took during that critical period. So there's a lot to be learnt from this period, not just for students of history. This is not just navel gazing. What this shows is that government is a positive force for good, that we didn't have the capital and skills destruction of our economy that has produced the Donald Trumps of this world and the ring of fire of nativists across so many right-wing movements across so many of the developed economies across the world. Good public policy based on good values and based on good instincts is what works for people and democracy. I introduce Tanya Plibersek.
I want to say how proud I am to stand beside our former Treasurer Wayne Swan in talking about this important issue, because the truth is that International Money Magazine Treasurer of the Year Award doesn't scratch the surface of what Wayne did during that time. Australia would have gone into recession for sure without his leadership. And it's an incredible thing that at that time of global uncertainty, employment grew by a million in Australia during our period in government. We added a million jobs, and around the world, 31 million jobs were lost. We think the stimulus package itself saved about 200,000 jobs. And I want to talk briefly about the sort of overarching lessons learnt from the response to the global financial crisis, and then I want to focus a little bit on some of the social policy elements, because as Wayne said, Jim in those days was right up to his neck in all of this stuff too, and he'll talk a little bit more about the economics of it. Can I recommend to anybody who hasn't read Wayne's book, The Good Fight, if you're interested in this stuff, reading the section about the global financial crisis. It's a terrific read, but Jim's also got a book called Glory Days, which has a lot of the behind-the-scenes sort of stuff in it, including some of the ways he had to look after Wayne at the time. There was a lot of flying at short notice and trying to actually be working in the air before they landed to have a policy that they were able to implement as quickly as possible. And that brings me to some of the lessons that we learnt. I think probably the most important lesson learnt was from what Ken Henry said at the time, go early, go hard, go households. I think the fact that we did that, went early, went hard, went households, is one of the most important elements of the success of this. The other element, aside from timely, temporary and targeted being important, was a philosophy that I think could best be described as never waste a crisis. And a lot of us have spoken, Ed Balls has spoken about this, Wayne, as well. The fact that we were already wanting to do work in the area of homelessness, we knew we had to spend money, we knew that construction was a huge employer, and if we could keep the construction industry going strong, that it'd have a flow-on effect to the rest of the economy, just gave us a brilliant opportunity to actually spend money in a way that was not just useful to the broader economy, but transformed the lives of many Australians. On the flip side, the other lesson learnt is if we'd left this to the Conservatives, we felt at times that we were making a decision between going into deficit and going into recession. If we'd left it to the Conservatives, we would have had both. We would have gone into a recession and then ended up dealing with the deficit after, you know, hundreds of thousands of people had lost their jobs. There was a very, very clear line from them that the first small stimulus was okay, but the larger, more substantial, later stimulus was overkill. Julie Bishop literally said we should sit and watch and wait. And if we had sat and watched and waited, we would have had another generation of people who lost their jobs, perhaps never to recover their economic circumstances. And this is the thing that burns me up so much about, as Wayne says, the continuing sort of rewriting of history from the Conservatives. If we had done what they suggested, we would have seen a generation of unemployed people, and not only that, we would have taken much longer to come out of the global recession. Their argument was that we did too much, and I think this, probably Jim's going to debunk this argument in more detail, but one of the judgments on did we do too much is, what was there an inflationary impact? What happened to growth? We kept growth strong. If we had not had the stimulus, we would have gone into recession. And there's another really good graph that shows that we would have contracted without the stimulus, but with stimulus, we still had a minor downturn, but we were able to continue to grow afterwards. The Conservatives kept saying what we should do is do what New Zealand did, which is give tax cuts instead of using stimulus. Well, if we'd done that, we would have had the same economic outcome as New Zealand, which is quarter after quarter of negative growth, compared with two separate quarters under us. The New Zealand example is not a good example. So I just want to turn very quickly to what we did in social policy. We, of course, had the first tranche of stimulus, $10.4 billion. Those payments went to pensioners, they went to families, they went to people on disability support pension, they went to carers. And we know, we saw very quickly that money make its way into the economy more broadly. People who need money spent it, and spent it quickly. And we had so many great stories of people getting new blinds for the lounge room, or travelling to see their grandkids, or buying Christmas presents for the grandkids. That they were all great ways to spend the money to keep other Australians employed. But the longer term investments are the ones that I particularly wanted to draw your attention to tonight, because they were the ones that got a lot of criticism from the Conservatives. The Building the Education Revolution investment in schools transformed our schools. Many of the schools that got those libraries or school halls or new science labs or new language labs or had renovations done had not had money spent on them in 20 years or 40 years or 60 years or, from the time they had been built. And the Australian newspaper, the Australian newspaper, had a team of people looking for reasons to badmouth it. They actually had journalists travelling to regional towns, door-knocking members of the PNC of the local school, I kid you not, saying, we'd like to talk to you about how terrible the Building the Education Revolution program is in your school. There was $1 billion over 3 years, 500 science laboratories or language learning centres. There was the $12.4 billion that went for upgrading or building major infrastructure such as multi-purpose halls and libraries. There was $1.3 billion for undertaking maintenance and minor building works, which is fantastic because people employ local contractors. That's right. Of course, it was rolled out very quickly. It was the first new infrastructure in most schools for decades. In New South Wales, there was a building program twice the size of the Sydney Olympics done in half the time while schools were continuing to operate, continuing to teach. So every worker on those projects also had to have a working with children check. They had to organise the work so that it wasn't disrupting classes. They had, of course, the Australian focusing on the complaints. Of nearly 24,000 projects nationally, there were 340 complaints. Now, if any of you have ever renovated your bathroom, you'll understand what a phenomenal achievement that is. And not all of those 340 were upheld in any case. The safety record for this building project in New South Wales was 7 times safer than general construction. And the thing that was most telling about this is when you spoke to anyone who had kids in a school or had a relationship with a school, they would say, oh, the building project in my school is fantastic. We love it. It's the best ever. But the program's a bit of a problem, isn't it? There was day after day of beat-ups in the Australian. So if there's another lesson learned, I'd say that we really need to find some other media outlet that we trust to tell real stories to Australians. And then I want to tell you this one as well. I'll finish on housing. I was the housing minister. We'd done the homelessness white paper. We knew that there was a huge deficit in public housing. The Howard government had cut and cut and cut and cut. They'd built no new housing. States were selling off existing housing stock. We knew that if we seriously wanted to do something about homelessness, we had to invest in more social housing. So we did. We built, during my time as housing minister, 21,600 new public housing dwellings. We delivered them ahead of time and under budget. And I can tell you, the people I met who moved into those homes, it changed their lives. The first home in New South Wales was a family with a teenage son who was very severely physically disabled and intellectually as well. But his mother and father and family lived on the second floor of an old apartment building. They were carrying his mother. His father had hurt his back. His mother was carrying this 14-year-old young man up and down the stairs if they wanted to leave the house. They moved into a house that was purpose-built with flat entry, a wheel-in bathroom, the reinforced walls for lifting equipment. It changed their lives. And there were thousands of people I met. I didn't meet thousands of people like that. Hundreds I met. A father who had lost contact with his two daughters because he didn't have a safe place for them to come and stay on the weekend when he had, with the mother's agreement, access to them. They couldn't go to his house. He had nowhere. He was homeless. He had nowhere for his daughters to sleep. This gave him not just a place to sleep, but opportunity to re-establish contact with his family. A fellow I met in Adelaide, he'd been sleeping rough for 15 years. 15 years he'd been sleeping rough, and we built a place that he was able to live in. It changed lives, and it created about 15,000 jobs over 2 years. It renovated 80,000 existing dwellings. 12,000 of them would have been lost to public housing because they're in such bad condition if we hadn't fixed them up. The construction industry in Australia employs about 9% of the total workforce, so you imagine what a fall in construction does. And the terrific thing about this is that we didn't just invest in social housing. It didn't just build extra social housing. Because some of the projects were bought off the plan or they were part of a development that a private developer was doing, it meant another 3,000 private homes came into the market because the financing became available for those homes to be constructed. And I tell you, the Liberal Party of Australia set up front groups in suburbs where this new public housing was being built, like Ryde in the marginal seat of Bennelong, and they campaigned against this. And they turned up to public meetings and they pretended that, you know what astroturfing is? Yeah. They set up a community organisation. They did it in a whole lot of communities. Same website, same information on the website, just different pictures and different names of suburbs. So the other lesson is that we have to be absolutely prepared to defend these programs and the huge difference they make to people's lives. And we have to deal with media like this while we're doing it. Jim Chalmers, of course, is our shadow finance spokesperson now, and he was Wayne's chief and deputy chief of staff at the time. He really saw this, the global financial crisis and our response to it from the inside, and he's taken what he's learned from that and he's doing an absolutely fine job as our shadow finance spokesperson. Thank you.
I think the fact that there's a group of this size and quality on a Sunday night really is a reflection of two related things. The first one is the remarkable success of the Australia Institute. And I wanted to congratulate Ben and Anna and Richard and Dave and everyone who works here. It's, as Tanya finished on in her contribution, it's almost impossible to shift the public debate in this country given the way that our media is constituted. And the fact that you have been able to do that repeatedly, consistently, especially over the last little while on things like company tax and the rest of it, I think is a real tribute to you. So if you could put your hands together, please, for the Australia Institute. I think a crowd like this is also a bit of a reflection of the regard that you have for Wayne and Tanya and what they were able to achieve in the global financial crisis, working, of course, with Kevin Rudd and with Jenny Macklin and Lindsay Tanner, and really one of the most remarkable cabinets that have been put together. The fact that they work together so effectively in dealing with the global financial crisis, I think it's amazing, really, that you are prepared to recognise that and to support Wayne and Tanya and the contribution that they made then and the contribution that they're making tonight. The third reason I think that we are together in such numbers tonight is because all of us appreciate that what happened 10 years ago is not just some piece of nice nostalgia or some set of fond memories that we have about a successful set of policies, but as the other speakers have said, what happened 10 years ago still matters a lot today. It matters to the economic conversation today, but it matters to something far more fundamental to that, which Wayne alluded to, which is the idea of what the role of government is in a society, in a civilised society, in a first world, first rate country like Australia. So I wanted to touch on some of those themes, but before I did, I wanted to recollect really that 10 years ago to this minute, I was in a hotel room in Washington, D.C. It was just after 3 a.m. and we had finished a couple of hours earlier that extraordinary cabinet meeting that Wayne alluded to, where we're in the poor unsuspecting teenager's bedroom talking to Kevin and Ken Henry and all of those colleagues in the cabinet room here in Canberra. I consider it the finest achievement of my life as a staffer, finding that secure line out of that kid's bedroom.
Those of you, there's a number of current and former staffers in the room who know exactly what I mean when that panic sets in and you have a task like that. And we found the secure line, and Wayne was sitting on the kid's bed and I was sitting on a futon in the corner scribbling notes from this speakerphone. And I'll never forget, I really will never forget that. But by about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was working with colleagues back here trying to cancel a couple of days' worth of events because we were coming home early. And we were also working on some of the initial language about how we would explain this extraordinary intervention that the Rudd cabinet with Wayne and others was planning to make in the economy. And we were worried, actually, that it was so dramatic that people would be scared, actually, by the response, that they would think that because a government was prepared to take such decisive action with a big price tag attached to it, we were worried that people would think, well, look, maybe this is worse than we thought. Of course, that didn't eventuate. A whole bunch of other memories from that period. I remember a lot about, and I'm very grateful for the time I spent working with Wayne. And I remember, you know, some of the downtimes in that period, not downtimes in terms of work, there was not much downtime in that period, but time on planes, time travelling, where he would talk about the primary motivation that he had was to try and avoid what happened to a lot of his contemporaries in the recession in the early 1990s. And so there was a personal element to it. He had a whole bunch of non-political friends who would text him from time to time, and I could always tell that those guys were front of mind because it was that generation, really Wayne's generation, in the early 90s who found themselves out of work, who found it very difficult to re-enter the workforce. And so I particularly enjoyed and benefited from those kind of personal insights that Wayne had during that period. And I remember Tanya's contribution really well as well because arguably as well, if not better, than all of the other ministerial colleagues at the time, I think that Tanya understood that, yes, we needed to do something very quickly with an immediate benefit to the economy, in her case, construction work in the housing sector. But I think she grasped better than or earlier than some of the other colleagues that by doing that you could make a lasting difference to the society. And those 21,600 public housing units really was a testament to the way that Tanya saw an opportunity there to do some genuine good in the community, not just get money out the door, as important as that was, not just employ construction workers, very important at the time, but to do something which lasts. And there's 21,600 monuments to that right around Australia, as Tanya spoke about a moment ago. So I remember all that. The other thing that's burned in my memory, and I used to, when I was in Canberra during that period, I actually used to have an apartment above the Coles across the street there, so it sort of comes back to me when I'm in this part of town. But I remember it got so crazy in that period and that we were so desperate for signs of life out of the American economy that somewhere between 2 and 2:15 a.m. every day we would get a written report by email from our post in the U.S. Which had material from New York and from D.C., the political and the financial. And just my body just trained itself to wake up at around that time to read that report. We were so desperately looking for signs of life, for signs that our stimulus had worked. And we knew that that was going to come partly from our intelligence gatherers in the US. All of those memories are incredibly vivid, even 10 years on. The one thing that I didn't remember until I was watching the video that Wayne put up today on his Facebook page, I encourage you to check it out and to share it. There's a really great video that Wayne's put up with some of the coverage from that period 10 years ago today. And the thing that came back to me then as I was watching it that I hadn't thought about for a long time was just the stress of the uncertainty of it, not just the uncertainty of what was going on in the economy, but whether or not we were actually getting it quite right. And because, you know, the facts now speak for themselves, because we avoided recession alone amongst the developed world, because 210,000 jobs were saved by the stimulus alone, because Joe Stiglitz said it was the best application of fiscal policy anywhere in the world, we become conditioned, I think, to believe that we always knew all along that it was going to go like this. But the reality is very different. And when I watch the footage in Wayne's video that he put up, and when I think about that period deeply now, that week that Wayne described, you know, the Reserve Bank cutting by 100 points, we went and got a briefing from Glenn Stevens at the time, all of that international intelligence gathering, the bank guarantee, the wholesale funding guarantee, and then the big first stimulus. Really, the uncertainty is what's coming back to me now as I reflect on it. And it began as the uncertainty that maybe we were doing too much, And then by the end of that seven-day period, it really became the uncertainty that we were doing too little. And that, as Wayne rightly points out, we were already starting to plan the second, a much bigger stimulus, which focused on infrastructure. Now, there's a lot of credit to go around for what Australia achieved during that period. The Reserve Bank, a lot of businesses held on to their workers. The Treasury, Finance Department, PM&C and others performed very admirably. I think the reason why we focus on the decision taken by senior ministers, and particularly that first stimulus package, is because it wasn't just the signal it sent, or it wasn't the specific impact of that first $10 billion. It was the message that it sent to the Australian people that they weren't on their own, that something bad was coming, sure, but we had a government that was prepared to do the right thing by them, no matter what the price tag attached to it might be. And so that had a remarkable impact on confidence. And confidence wasn't thick on the ground in that time. And so I think it was really important that the ministers, Wayne and Kevin and Tanya and others, Jenny and Lindsay and others, were sending the signal to Australians that they weren't on their own. And I think there really is something in that. Tonight feels a little bit like a celebration. It may have been certainly one of Australia's finest peacetime achievements, what was achieved 10 years ago. But as I said before, I don't think that we should necessarily be nostalgic about it, because what we mark tonight does have, as Wayne said, a much deeper philosophical meaning. And what it represents really is the triumph of our progressive economics, shared by many of you in this room, over that kind of scorched earth mentality that says that people are on their own. When something bad happens, they're on their own. And 10 years ago, our version of economics, our version of a society, won out. And the reason that this still matters now is because we're having, in a different context, a lot of the same fights. And the stakes are very high. Our opponents understand that the stakes are very high. The fact that they're still writing editorials in the Oz and the Fin about Wayne and 10 years on shows that they understand that the stakes are very high because of that deeper philosophical contest. I know that you understand that the stakes are very high too. And we've got a number of caucus colleagues here. I think Justine Kay and Ross Hart and Anthony Chisholm and Deb O'Neill. And we all understand in the Labor caucus just how high the stakes are in this argument that we're having even now 10 years on about the success of the stimulus. Now, just because the global financial crisis, the form that it took a decade ago, is no longer with us, it doesn't mean that there isn't a different kind of really crisis level challenge that we are facing in this country. The difference now is the global financial crisis was a crisis created by the bundling up of a whole bunch of dodgy mortgages and on-selling and all kinds of ridiculous financial instruments. Now it's a different kind of crisis. Now the crisis is really the bundling together of neighbourhoods, the bundling together of suburbs, the concentration of parts of our country, where no matter how hard you work, you can't get a decent wage. And we've got that. It's a crisis now of stagnant wages and high household debt and housing, lack of housing affordability, all of those sorts of things. It's just a different kind of crisis now. It's a crisis of inequality, it's a crisis of immobility, which is something I care very deeply about given where I represent and where I'm from in my part of Queensland. And it's also a crisis of insecurity, insecure work. The fact that no matter what people do, the rules of the economy are written to benefit somebody else at their expense. That's what we're up against now. It's a very different set of conditions, but I think the stakes are just as high. It's a crisis that comes from a Conservative government which works around the clock, really, to undermine the three most important aspirations of economic policy. First one, that growth is inclusive. People have a stake in the wealth that they create. Secondly, they get a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. And thirdly, that there's a decent social safety net for people who are left behind. The final point I'll make really responds to something that Ben alluded to a moment ago. He talked about the seminar that he organised with colleagues here for when Ed Balls was out here. And one of the conversations that we're having in the time, and one of the conversations which happens in the commentary, still happens now, is that somehow progressives like us, you know, we missed an opportunity in the aftermath of the global financial crisis to dramatically change how our economy is structured and how our society is structured as a consequence. And I've enjoyed engaging with Ben on this a couple of times now, because the way I see it, I think that the opportunity is still right there, right in front of us. And that the opportunity has not yet been grasped doesn't mean that the opportunity won't be grasped. And I think if you think about the really remarkably progressive policies which have been put out there under Bill Shorten's leadership in the last 5 years and one day, you can understand that we fully intend to grasp the opportunity to properly reshape the post-crisis economy. We intend to do it in tax, most noticeably. We want to have a far more progressive tax system. We intend to do it in industrial relations. We tend to clean up the financial services sector, which is being exposed, you know, almost every day in the Royal Commission, which Labor fought for. We intend to do all of these things. We don't intend to miss the opportunity to properly reshape the economy in the interests of ordinary people, people who work and struggle in this country. And when we do that, and I'm sure I speak for Deb and Anthony and Justine and Ross and Wayne and Tanya and many of you here, when I say that we will be just as brave and just as courageous and just as progressive as we were 10 years ago when Wayne and Tanya and their colleagues did such a great job saving Australia from the Great Recession. Thank you.
A great summation of what was achieved, what's still at stake, what more can be done, and how important the arguments still are for what comes next. And I alluded to that polling a little bit before, that, you know, despite those pictures that Tanya held up of the press that we're still against, and despite those editorial claims are still going on against Wayne, that 62% of the Australian public do think the stimulus package saved us from recession. So I think there is a disconnect between some elements of the media, political class and the population that is ripe for that recasting. It's why the Australian Institute loves being involved in the big economic debates of our time and think it's so important, and this is absolutely central to it. And it's so important that the progressive side of politics can chart a decent economic, a progressive policy agenda and a narrative that you heard across the board here tonight. But where's the business community? Where's the Business Council of Australia talking about that Australia's got 30% more GDP now than it would have compared to, what, 12% for the UK or 17% for the US, let alone Greece, minus 20% now on what it was. Where's the Business Council of Australia? What a disaster it is. We're having fun taking on the BCA. Thanks to these people here and many people in this room, we defeated them on the company tax cut fight, I think economically and politically. There's more to come on climate change. Those people need taking on. And we need to do the kicking when it needs doing, like the BCA. We need to chart a positive vision too, which we heard plenty of tonight. So thank you to Wayne and to Tanya and to Jim. And thank you all here who are so engaged in this progressive economic debate. Absolutely central to the coming months, weeks and years.
That's a summer special episode of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. A very big thank you to Wayne Swan, Tanya Plibersek and Jim Chalmers. You can find Wayne Swan on Twitter at SwanyQLD. Tanya Plibersek is at Tanya_Plibersek and Jim Chalmers is at J.E. Chalmers. You can find the Australia Institute at the Oz Institute with an AUS, and you can find me at Ebony_Bennett with a NNTT. Listen free to Follow the Money wherever you download your favourite podcasts. Politics in the Pub is recorded live by Clayton McDonald, and this episode was produced by Jennifer Macy with additional editing by Lizzie Jack. Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum composed our title track, and you can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thanks for listening.